please open your New Testament to John chapter 5. The first 16 verses of that chapter, as we initiate our study of the lame man at Bethesda. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem, by the sheep market, a pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. And in these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first after the troubling of the water stepped in was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. And a certain man was there which had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he saith unto him, Wilt thou be made whole? The impotent man answered him, Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool. But while I am coming, another steppeth down before me. And Jesus said unto him, Rise, take up thy bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made whole, took up his bed and walked. And the same day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, It is the Sabbath day, and it is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. He answered them, He that made me whole, the same said unto me, Take up thy bed and walk. Then they asked him, What man is it which said unto thee, Take up thy bed and walk? And he that was healed was not who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in that place. Afterward, Jesus findeth him in the temple and said unto him, Behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest the worst thing come unto thee. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. Now verse 1 says, After this there was a feast of the Jews. And it's important to remember that John is probably the most chronological of the New Testament writers of the narrative of the life of Jesus. But he is not necessarily inclusive of everything. And so from the time that we last saw Jesus in Samaria until now is probably over a period of 4 months. And there are other things that we could fit in between those two events that would account for the time perhaps. But the point I'm trying to make to you is that this is probably another Passover. So we're into the next year of the ministry of Jesus, and yet there's been a lot of things left out. So John is not seeking to include everything, but he includes those things which are in keeping with his purpose as stated in chapter 20. These things are written that you might believe, and believing have life in his name. Back in chapter 4, verse 35, the disciples had said at some point in their coming to Samaria, it's 4 months into the harvest. Well, if that were the case, then this brings us to about February at least. And so the Passover was sometime after the harvest, about the harvest time. So we're in the early spring of this year, 28 AD. Now Jesus came at this time to Jerusalem, to the pool of Bethesda. Now we're familiar with that name Bethesda because it happens to be the same name that is used by the American Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. And so we generally refer to it as, or used to when I was younger, refer to it as the Bethesda Naval Hospital. Now it's Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. I think that's how it is. But we used to call it Bethesda Naval. And so it's that town is named after this pool. And that hospital has taken that name in connection with this miracle. And it literally means House of Mercy. So it's a good name for a hospital. And I'm sure that's why it was adopted. But this place where Jesus met this man was a pool that bore the name Bethesda, and there were five porches. There are porticos that surrounded this pool, and the sick and crippled and lame and otherwise infirm came to this place because it was reputed to be a source of some sort of miracle. It's difficult to know exactly where this pool was in Jerusalem. It is generally thought to have been on the western side of Jerusalem, enclosed within the walls by Manasseh, and was a part of the system of water that flowed from the Gihon spring. Some have suggested that the name for the pool draws its name from, or the name of the spring is what explains the event at Bethesda Pool. In other words, Gihon means bursting forth, and it was an artesian stream. And so during the reign of Hezekiah, he dug an aqueduct from Gihon all the way into Jerusalem, and that aqueduct has since been found, and you can study about that if you wanted to. But Gihon bursting forth, a living water, and sometimes this idea of bursting forth was is rather sudden. There was a gush of water that came out. And so some have suggested that that's what this angel was that troubled the waters, this gush of water. Well, I don't like that, so I'm going to pass over that one. But then others have said, well, this miracle is explained just by pagan ritual and legend, and that the Jews had adopted that in association with this pool. Well, I don't like that one either, because first of all, there's no fact for it, no basis of fact for it. And second of all, why would the Jews adopt something that was clearly pagan at this part of their history associated with idolatry? So that doesn't satisfy anything. Well, others have come along and pointed out that the verse 4, the latter half of verse 4 in particular, but verse 4 and part of verse 3 are not in the American Standard Version. So if you're looking at an American Standard Version or a New American Standard Version, perhaps you have some marginal reference to the fact that part of these verses do not appear in the older text. That may also be true in the New King James Version. Well, again, I don't like that. I don't like anything that tries to take away from the Bible or impute what the Bible says to something that's not supernatural when the Bible says it is associated with the supernatural. So it doesn't bother me that God may have allowed an angel to have come down and troubled the water, any more than it doesn't bother me that God allowed demons to possess the men of Israel at this time. And you have Jews who were involved with these things, the Jewish exorcists that we read about there in the book of Acts in chapter 17. And so the Jews were indeed interested in these things and even sometimes corrupted these things and manipulated them in such a way as that they got themselves involved in things that they shouldn't have. So it's altogether possible that this is a supernatural event. The text says it was, so I'm going to believe that it was, and really don't have to worry about trying to explain it any more than I have to explain that when Pharaoh's magicians threw down their rods, they became serpents as well. I don't think they had that power. They seem to have been as surprised at it as everyone else was. But it served God's purpose. And so let's just not try and second guess the Lord here. Let's just accept what the text says. But here's the most important thing. The miracle does of the supernatural character of this water bubbling and all of that has nothing to do with the miracle that Jesus wrought, other than the fact that it is a part of the background information that explains why this man was there. And that's all you have to know about it. If you want to ask the Lord about it later, feel free to do so. But it's not important to understanding because Jesus was not involved with any of this, you see. Jesus is going to demonstrate something here very powerful that is associated with himself as the Son of God. So there was this certain man there, and he was one of a great many impotent folk, or a great multitude of impotent folk, it says. This word impotent, which the English word means powerless, suggests feeble in any sense, to be diseased, to be sick, to be weak. It is a general term that describes folks with debilitating illnesses. We don't have a diagnosis, and again, that's not necessary. But of all the people in this crowd, Jesus went to the one who had been infirm 38 years. Probably this man's lifetime, or at least the most productive part of it. We don't know how he became feeble or impotent, but he had been this way a long time. And the reason why the length of his illness is mentioned might be for any number of reasons. First of all, it certainly explains the compassion of Christ. Here's someone who's suffering, but not just suffering a little bit, who's suffering a lot. Here's someone who's suffered probably most of their adult life. And so Jesus is touched by that, and he is moved with compassion. Many times in the scriptures, there in Matthew 14:14, for example, Jesus comes to a multitude, and seeing how many people there were that were sick and diseased and so forth, he began to heal all of them. And that took a lot out of Jesus. And so the length of his suffering may be intended to explain the compassion of Christ. The length of his suffering may be intended to make sure that everyone realizes that this man is not a plant. He's not a shill. He's not a faker. I don't know if you've ever gone to a healing service. I've been to several in my time. And I think I even took some of the young people here one time over here to the Pentecostal church when I was here the first time to a healing service. And I've witnessed these so-called healings. And sometimes someone who's really deformed or injured or infirm gets to the healer, and now he's got to deal with someone who has a leg or an arm or something that's withered. And of course, there's always the explanation is giving, well, you don't have enough faith. You know, you can get your liver spots cured because nobody can see them. And you can get your other internal infirmities corrected because there's no way to tell whether it was true or not. But someone who is missing a leg or someone who has a withered arm. I had a fellow out in Amarillo that I used to take with me sometimes who literally had a withered arm. He had fallen off a horse, or actually the horse had fallen on him after it threw him and broke his wrist, and it never was right again. It was kind of at a 30-degree angle on the end of his arm, and his arm was kind of withered up. And so I've got somebody I'll bring to one of these healing meetings, and we'll see if we can't get some healing done. And so those people they want to avoid. But here's someone who was obviously infirm, known to have been infirm, and Jesus chose him out of all the people that were present on this occasion. And so in all of Jesus' miracles, this one included, the Lord chose the circumstances in order to teach powerful lessons concerning himself and the great salvation which is brought. And so rather than looking at the facts, the facts are stated, all right? So we just accept the facts as they are and let the text tell us why Jesus did what he did. And the text says there very clearly that it was the Sabbath day, verse 9, and on the same day was the Sabbath. And then this was a issue for them because they said later, who told thee to take up your bed? Don't you know that it is unlawful, verse 10, for you to carry your bed? And the fact of the matter is, it wasn't unlawful, but we'll deal with that in a moment. But then again, then in verse 16, the text says, because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. And so the reason for this miracle being wrought is because of the day on which Jesus did it, and those who would have witnessed it and were able to witness it, and what it created as a circumstance in order for Jesus to teach. Now, having said that, I want to emphasize this truth. Jesus was not using this man. To have used this man would have been not to have healed him. To have used this man would have been to make some sort of example out of him that was unfavorable to his character or whatever. But Jesus did not do that. Whatever Jesus said to him later, he said to him privately and not before all the individuals in the audience. Jesus did this for the glory of God. Jesus did this to help this man, and this man understood that. Now let's get into the text and see what Jesus and this man have to say to one another. The Lord puts the question to him, "Wilt thou be made whole?" And that's rather an obvious question, and perhaps it doesn't need an answer, but when you read the answer of the man, you understand that he is without any expectation of something miraculous. The text clearly says he did not know who Jesus was. It says it twice, that he didn't know who Jesus was. So here Jesus walks up to him, a complete and total stranger, and says, "Will you be made whole?" And then the man immediately responds to Jesus saying, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is troubled. But while I'm coming, another steppeth down before me." So the man assumes that Jesus understands what is involved in the ritual of obtaining the healing. You've got to get up and get into the water when the water is troubled. You evidently had to be the first one because it was first come, first serve, and everybody else was left out. And so the man says, "I have no one to help put me into the pool." And so Jesus, without any further delay, says to him, "Rise, take up your bed, and walk." So when he answers the question, it implies a yes, he would, but I don't have anybody to help me. And furthermore, when he does so, saying as he does, it's clear that he doesn't know who Jesus is. So therefore, he can't have any faith in Christ. Now, I mention this because just a moment ago, I talked about modern day faith healers. And if they can't cure something, they say, well, it's the fault of the one who's seeking the miracle because they didn't have enough faith. This man didn't have any faith at all. This man wasn't expecting anything. He was looking for help to get into the water. He wasn't looking for a miracle. He says, "I don't have anybody to help me get into the water." And so clearly here is a man without faith, without any expectation whatever of a miracle from Jesus. And he says, "Yes, I want to be healed, but," and then Jesus says, "Rise, take up thy bed, and walk." And then the text goes on to say, immediately the man was made whole and took up his bed and walked, and on the same day was the Sabbath. So immediately the man was made whole. That word immediately means just that, immediately, without delay, in that moment, in that instant. So while it is true that one may say that sometimes the miracles of Jesus are examples of people who I was listening to a podcast the other day, and a young man said that he believed that all of the miracles of Jesus were parables of salvation. We need to be careful when we say things like that. There's no doubt in my mind that some instances of Jesus working a miracle did require faith on the part of those that were healed. The next great miracle we study in the book of John in chapter 9 is just such a miracle, the healing of the lame man who washed in the pool of Siloam. It's an incredible story. But that's not what you have here. This man had no faith at all. So if this makes it a parable of salvation, here's someone who can be saved without faith. Well, I don't believe that. No one believes that. Because some have thought this, they try to make faith, find the man having some kind of faith in verse 9. But look at verse 9. Immediately the man was made whole. Where is there any indication that he had faith? He had just said, "I don't have anybody to help me get in the water." And Jesus said, "Rise, take up thy bed and walk." And immediately he was made whole. It doesn't say he tried to get up, and because he was trying to get up, he was made whole. No, it said immediately he was made whole. There's nothing here to indicate that the man had faith. Now, I said a moment ago, some certainly did when they came to Jesus. the man born of four. There was not only his faith, but the faith of the four men that brought him. They tore up the ceiling and laid him down in front of Jesus. The same thing of the centurion in Matthew chapter 8. You remember he said, I am a man under authority. I say to this one, go, and he goes. I say to that one, come, and he comes. I too understand about being under authority. You say the word, and it'll be done. Jesus said, I have not found so great faith in all of Israel. So sometimes there was faith, but not every time. And I'll just mention this as an aside, since we're talking about miracles. There are only two miracles that I know of in the New Testament that failed. The one in Matthew chapter 17, which was the disciples who could not cast out the demon in the epileptic boy. Jesus came and cast him out, but they couldn't cast him out. And they asked the Lord, why couldn't we cast him out? And Jesus didn't say, well, because the little boy didn't have enough faith. He said, because you didn't have enough faith. The same thing is true in Acts chapter 19 with the seven sons of Sceva who tried to cast the demon out of the demon-possessed man. He says, in the name of Jesus Christ, whom Paul preaches, I adjure thee to come out. And the demon said, well, Paul I know, and Jesus I know, but who are you? And he beat the living daylights out of the fellow. One of the funniest stories in all the Bible. Why? Because that demon knew those guys didn't have faith. They didn't believe in Jesus, and they certainly didn't believe Paul was his apostle. And so the only two miracles that we read about that failed on account of the faith of the one who was trying to work the miracle, not on the account of the faith of the one upon whom the miracles worked. Now, if I'm wrong about that, someone can straighten me out, but I think that's the truth. So here we have this man without any faith being healed. And so it does not illustrate salvation, but rather it illustrates a lot of things. It illustrates the compassion of Christ, the grace of God, and so forth. And Jesus wanting to engage in this controversy about the Sabbath, and that becomes apparent in verse 17 after we read a little further here. But the evidence of this man's healing is overwhelming. He had been infirm for 38 years. He says, I have no man to help me. So there wasn't anyone else there besides Jesus and this man. He wasn't put into the water. I have no man to help me put me into the water. He wasn't in the water, and Jesus didn't offer to put him in the water. There's no indication that the angel was even present on this occasion. Jesus, he says, I have no man to put me in the water when the angel comes. You know, this is the pitiful thing about this poor man. Every day he's lifted and carried up there and set by the pool of Bethesda. And then whoever it is that helps him get up there evidently leaves him. And maybe they come back at the end of the day and they get him. And you know, that's the way it is a lot of times with we get people to help us. Well, they can't just give up their life and sit there with us and wait on an angel when he decides to come down from heaven and trouble the water. And so it's kind of a sad situation. Here's a fellow who really doesn't have any prospect of this working for him. But he's still there. He still wants to be healed. He still wants to be able to walk. And so Jesus comes to him, and Jesus just simply says, arise, take up your bed, and walk. There's the power of the word of Christ. Now there's the lesson. There's the thing that parallels salvation. If you want to be saved, who are you going to have to come to? You're not going to have to come to a man. It's not going to be an angel. It's not going to be some contrived, supposed system, but you're going to have to do what Christ says do. You're going to have to believe what Christ says. You're going to have to come to Christ. And so Jesus spoke the word. So the power is in the words of Jesus. Now, as I mentioned, the same day was the Sabbath there, according to verse 9. And from there, the discourse changes. Jesus conveyed himself away because there was a multitude in that place. You know, Jesus had to deal with crowds every day. And so here is a situation where he's at this place. We have no indication at all why he came there. it may have been just to do this miracle. It may have been on his way to the temple or whatever it was. There's no indication of why he was in this place. But in this place, he saw this man. But he didn't want to get balled up in this multitude. If he'd healed this one, then what else? I'm going to have to heal all the rest of them. Now, that's not saying that Jesus didn't have compassion on the rest of them, but we need to understand, and so many people don't, even our own brethren don't. Jesus did not come to heal all the sick. Jesus did not come to feed all the hungry. You know, when Jesus was talking about the lepers, he said, you know, there were a lot of lepers in Israel, but he only healed Naaman. And he was a Gentile. You know, that was the rub on that. But you know, he didn't heal everybody. Even the prophet didn't heal them all. And so this is what people don't understand. That's not why Jesus came. And so this miracle clearly has to be understood in the context of the greater purpose, which is to believe that he is the Christ. But the Jews saw him carrying his bed, and they said to him that was cured. So obviously, there was some understanding that this fella had been lame. And I said, who? Don't you know that it's not right or lawful for you to carry your bed on the Sabbath day? And it's amazing to me, if they recognized this man as someone who'd been laid at Bethesda and had been crippled, what would be the first word out of your mouth? Wouldn't it be to, hey, how did that happen to you? How is it that you're walking? This is incredible. I'm so happy for you. Well, what happened? No. Don't you know it's not right for you to carry your bed on the Sabbath day? It's astounding to me how these Jews are so focused on trying to criticize people in such a way that there's not anything that anybody can do that's right. The word for that is censoriousness. Jesus condemned it in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, judge not that you be not judged. And then later we're told in John to judge righteous judgment. All right? So he's not condemning judging. He's condemning censorious judging. He's condemning judging that isn't fair, that isn't right, that isn't reasonable. And so here is this man. He's been crippled and he's carrying his bed. And they can't find anything good to say other than, don't you know it's unlawful? And I love this answer because it should have shut everything down. And basically it did. He said, well, verse 11 there, he that made me whole told me, take up your bed and walk. Now that's the end of the argument. What is it that Nicodemus said when Jesus came to him? We know that thou art a teacher come from God. Why? Because no man can do the things that you do except God be with him. They had caught Jesus in the temple there in chapter 2 a year before and had asked him for a sign. But what sign do you give us that you have the authority to do these things? And he doesn't give them a sign other than to say that tear down this temple in 3 days I'll raise it up. But the sign was he himself there because Malachi had prophesied that the Messiah would come to the temple and would be righteously indignant at what was going on there. But now here he gives them the sign. This is what they've been wanting. He gives them a sign. And are they concerned about it? They dismiss the sign. They dismiss the miracle and focus on the fact that this fellow is carrying his bed on the Sabbath day. And this miracle was clearly witnessed by a large group of people, at least the effects of it. Don't you know that the people that were there at Bethesda, he'd been there every day. They knew, hey, isn't that the fellow that was just laying over there a little while ago? Well, there was another man talking to him. What's going on here? Don't you know that place was a buzz? And so there was a great multitude of people in that place. But Jesus conveyed himself away, the text says. I don't know if that was miraculous or not. He seems to have been miraculous when he escaped the crowd in Nazareth. It may have been. It may not have been. I don't know. I know God's capable of doing it. He did it with Philip the evangelist. So it matters not. But later we see Jesus meeting him in the temple. the text clearly says that Jesus found him in the temple. Now, it's about a kilometer from Gaian to the temple. So that's a pretty good walk. Don't you know that fellow was happy? Boy, if he hadn't been on a walk in a long time, and here he is walking to the temple. Walks in right into the temple, right through the eastern gate where everybody is coming in, and he's just so happy he can walk to the temple. And he goes in, and why would he go to the temple? I mean, why didn't he go home? Why go to the temple? Well, maybe he thought he needed to thank God. Maybe he wanted to be up there and worship God. Maybe he thought he needed to do something to show that he was truly grateful. And you see, the thing about it is the temple would have been crowded too, wouldn't it? Because it's Passover time. So he's walking through the streets and there's just people all over the place. And he's on his way and he walks in and there's people in there. And yet Jesus finds him. And he says to him, "Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you." Well, before I talk about that, I need to say a little bit about this charge that was made that it was unlawful. I said that isn't the case, and that's true. I want you to turn. I could read a half a dozen or more passages, but I think the one that summarizes it best, and this is the one I want you to remember, is Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 15. Nehemiah 13 and verse 15. Of course, this is in the period of the restoration after the Babylonian captivity, but the law hasn't changed. And Nehemiah is acting as a great restorer and reformer, trying to get the Jews back on the right path. And he said, "In those days saw I in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves, and lading or loading asses, as also wine and grapes and figs and all manner of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals." Now, when Moses had said, "You're not going to do any work on the Sabbath day," and they tested that law in Numbers chapter 13 with the man who was, excuse me, Numbers chapter 30, I'll get it right here in a minute, chapter 15, verses 32 through 36, that they tested that law, the man picking up sticks, they put him in ward, and then God said, "Stone him." Right? Well, what was he doing? Picking up sticks. Well, that seems harmless. No, he's picking up sticks to build a fire. And they were not to kindle any fire in their home. All right? So he's talking about work, servile labor. And here, Nehemiah is clearly pointing out what was wrong in the law. It was wrong to work in the economic realm and to have failed to prepare for the Sabbath day, which we see the Jews doing, particularly in the death of Jesus, because it was the preparation. Friday, they needed to get things done, because Saturday was the Sabbath. So they were running out of time. And so there was a time when the Jews made preparation for the Sabbath, and in keeping the Sabbath, God made sure they always had provision. That was the whole point of the manna in the wilderness, was that they gathered an omer every day, and then on Friday, what'd they do? They gathered twice as much. Why? Because Saturday was the Sabbath, and they had to have some for Saturday. But they didn't kindle any fire in their home. So this is the law that was being broken. Now, Jesus healed several people on the Sabbath day. In Matthew chapter 12, when he was challenged on his attitude about the Sabbath, having healed the man with the withered arm in the synagogue, Jesus makes the point, says, "Well, wait a minute. Not all work, not every activity is prohibited on the Sabbath day. Why? Because the priests," Matthew 12 and verse 5, "profane the Sabbath." Well, what were the priests doing? Well, they were bringing animals into the temple. They were slaying those animals. They were flaying those animals in their parts and washing the parts and laying them on the altar and building a fire on the altar. Right? So Jesus uses the word profane in the same sense that the Jew would use it. Says, you say it's all work is prohibited. Well, the priest profaned the Sabbath according to your argument, you see. Then Jesus in Luke chapter 13, when healing the woman. It says, which of you having an ox? And he says similar thing in Matthew chapter 12 with regard to an ass. It says, which of you having an ox or an ass will not loose him and lead him to water on the Sabbath? And what Jesus is simply pointing out here, that it is right to do good. It is right to do those things that are associated with worship. So there is some activity that a person must and can engage in that's right and must be done. And so Jesus' conclusion in Mark was, is that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. It was never intended to be a burden, but the Jews had turned it into a burden. So here's a man who could clearly, under the teaching of the rabbis, carry his bed or have his bed carried because he was infirm. And now here he is, he's been healed. And Jesus said, take up your bed and walk. He says, well, the fellow who healed me, he must have the authority of God or else he couldn't have healed me. And so that settles that question. And that's basically what he says here. You know, he that healed me said, take up your bed and walk. And so that was the end of the argument. But Jesus, as I said a moment ago, finds him in the temple and comes up to him and says, behold, thou art made whole, verse 14. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you. Now what Jesus recognizes here is that this man has been healed, and he acknowledges that. Jesus is not making light of his infirmity in any way at all, but he's using this occasion of his healing as an opportunity to teach this man a much more important truth. I mean, have you ever known anybody who, after having overcome some terrible difficulty in life or maybe having a medical recovery or whatever it is, that they just kind of go off on a wild spree? And because they just feel some kind of release and they're really not concerned. And so Jesus comes to this man and he says, look, you've been made whole. Now you need to make proper use of this blessing. Go and sin no more, lest a worse thing comes upon you. First of all, Jesus recognizes that this man had sinned. And that's what he's telling this man. Go and sin no more. See, he was in the temple. He was in the right place. He was certainly being thankful and recognizing his relationship to God as being important. But he's saying to Jesus is saying to him, there's something much more important than the fact that you can walk now. The fact that you can walk gives you an opportunity to take advantage of life. And in the taking advantage of life, what you need to do is to not sin anymore. So first of all, Jesus recognizes the man is a sinner. He recognizes the universality of sin. But he doesn't put the blame for this man's sickness on him because he sinned. That was the question that was asked by the disciples with Jesus later. Who sinned, this man or his parents? And Jesus said, neither. We're in a broken world. And a broken world, part of a broken world is sin, is sickness and disease. People say, why did God let that come on me? God didn't do that. God didn't make you sick. God didn't cause anybody to die. That all happened back in the garden. When Adam and Eve, when Eve believed the lie and Adam acted high-handedly and sinned against God, that's when that all started. And the devil's responsible for that, because then all of these things came into the world and men were cut off from the tree of life. And so we die. And so that's not on God, that's on the devil, that's on sin and men who continue in sin, but they're not sick because they sin, necessarily. Second, what Jesus does here is recognize, or deny, I guess I should say, human inability. What does Jesus say? He says, go and sin no more. You don't have to sin. I heard a fellow say one time, well, if you got up this morning and put your feet over the side of the bed, you've sinned. I don't believe that. I don't believe you have to sin every day. Sin multiple times every day. Just sin, sin, sin all the time. I mean, why are we trying to be Christians? Why are we trying to follow Jesus? Why are we trying to live right if there's just no point to it? you're just going to sin anyway. And that's what your friends and your neighbors, some of them, believe. And so that's why they're not concerned about drinking, and that's why they're not concerned about being married without the right reason, or engaging in fornication, any number of things. People are not concerned. Why? Because, well, everybody sins, you know. That's what grace is for. That's not the biblical teaching of grace at all. Jesus told this man to go and sin no more. That's what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 34. He says, awake unto righteousness and sin not. Now, I'm not saying that you can't sin, and I'm not saying that you don't sin. I'm saying you don't have to sin. And we need to be trying to get to the point in our life where we're sinning less and less. And that brings us to the third thing Jesus said. Go and sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you. Worse than what? Worse than being crippled? There's something worse than being crippled. The Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 10, when he's talking about the punishment of sin, he says there in verses 28 and 29, says, he that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses, of how much sorer punishment suppose ye shall be thought worthy of, who hath trodden under foot the Son of God, and hath counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing, and hath done despite to the Spirit of grace. There's something worse than death. And that's what Jesus is trying to get this man to understand. You've been made whole. You've been given a great opportunity here. Now, what are you going to do with it? Don't waste it on a life of sin, but go and sin no more. You live a righteous life. What's the greatest thing that any person can do with his life? Be holy. What did Peter say in quoting the book of Leviticus there in chapter 1 and verse 16 of his first letter? He says, be ye holy, for I am holy. You don't have to be a millionaire. You don't have to be a great doctor and cure cancer. What you need to be is a righteous, holy person. That's the best thing you can do with your life. And that's why the common people heard Jesus gladly. Because they understood that really making God happy, living a life that pleases the God of heaven, is indeed the most important thing. Now, you can be a doctor that cures cancer and live a righteous life. And you can be a millionaire and live a righteous life. But you'll never be those things if being a righteous person, a holy person, is not the most important thing to you. See, it's a matter of priorities.